the inside. She got the scoop on the ones to watch, on the ones that's hot. No one can do it quite like Caroline. Caroline. No one can do it quite like Caroline. It's time for Caroline.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to Hyper Caroline Hobby. I am your host, Caroline Hobby. I know music, I know people, and I know the questions you want to ask. So let's get hyper. Heads up, these are adults having adult conversations, so there could be adult content. Hey, y'all. Thanks for tuning in to Hyper. This week is lit. They are a huge rock band. They had some of the biggest hits. I think one of the longest number ones of all time. It went 12 weeks. My Own Worst Enemy. And they were eaten by Pamela Anderson. If you're going to get eaten by someone, it might as well be Pamela Anderson. So please welcome AJ and Jeremy Popoff from the band Lit. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
So I'm here with the Popoff brothers. Introduce yourselves. Popoff brothers.
Yeah.
It does. It's very, it catches your attention.
Pop off, like popping off, and lit have become two popular terms in pop culture these days. So we're,
I think
we're about 15, 20 years ahead of our time.
What does pop off mean in pop culture?
Like
popping off?
Like, I don't know, one of them reality shows, a girl was just like, pop off, pop off.
Perfect. So where are we right now? What is this awesome venue that we're sitting in Nashville?
This is the Redneck Social Club.
Okay.
Yeah, it's our management headquarters.
Which is awesome. It's like a bar, a dance hall. It's kind of like in a cool, like, street cred kind of location.
It's got a sort of stripped down music venue, you know, private party vibe.
Do you guys throw some parties in here?
We've been to a couple.
You have?
Yeah.
Okay.
We had actually
stage over there, and bands get up and jam, and
we got to find a clip to throw in right here of the karaoke that took place. Or was I don't know if it was karaoke.
Oh, karaoke.
It was sort of like an American Idol
like
audition. It was amazing.
Was everybody sober doing this?
Oh, absolutely.
So it sounded great.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was amazing.
So I want to start off with a little rapid fire. First off, well, actually, I want you to describe yourself, but I want to do rapid fire first. What is the coolest venue that you guys have ever played? You guys are in the band Lit, for everyone's listening. Jeremy and AJ Popoff, they are in the band Lit. They're founding members. They're also brothers.
Yes, ma'am.
And they're also amazing. Coolest venue you've ever played?
Man, I'd say some of the European festivals we've done. Just like fields of people. That's insane.
I bet.
So, I mean, that's I guess that's not really a venue, but...
Red Rocks in Denver.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Pretty breathtaking.
Pretty.
We've played some amazing little tiny places and some amazing. The first we played Baltimore Ravens Stadium. That was like our first huge show that we ever played, and that was you know, an impressionable day because we had never played in front of it, played in something that big before. So that was kind of gnarly, and it messed us up too because we were on the big screen on the other side of the football field, so there was a delay. So I was like doing my rock pose, and I saw the screen, and my hands were in a different place than they were on the neck.
Oh,
and
no.
It totally messed me up.
Did it really?
Yeah. So I learned to not look at those screens after that.
Oh, yeah. Was it a bad mess up?
I mean, you know.
It's always weird just seeing a giant version of yourself, too.
Right.
You just kind of want to keep looking. And it's very distracting.
That is true. Okay. Weirdest thing you've ever seen on the road?
Weirdest thing. Maybe like we're, you know, in the after party, like meet and greet stuff. Mm-hmm. I've autographed a glass eyeball before.
Oh, like in an eye?
This guy pulled his eye out and wanted us to sign his glass eye. Oh, that was weird shit.
That's so weird. Yeah.
I think when you're a band touring your first time out, so many things are weird because you're in so many new places and you're meeting new people and, you know, the food is different or the cities look different and then after a while, like, none of it's weird anymore. It's like kind of all normal. So
that's true. Once you've seen so much, it's like anything goes.
Yeah.
Favorite country you've been to?
Japan, I think, is my favorite.
Why?
Because for me, I'm not a big fan of flying. I'm not afraid of flying. I'm not a fan of sitting down in a chair for 14 hours.
True.
So if I'm going to go through all that pain and agony of being locked up for that long, when I get off the plane, I want to be somewhere that's like another planet. When you fly from New York to Frankfurt, Germany, you get off the plane, you're like, this looks kind of like anywhere in America, you know?
Yeah.
But when you get to Japan, you know you're
in a foreign country,
and it's yeah, very modern and cool, and I love the food, I love the culture.
That's awesome. What about you, AJ?
I would probably say Japan as well. I mean, just because it's, you know, if you're going to travel there's so many parts of Europe that just feels like the East Coast or something, you know, it's not super, I don't know, you don't feel like you're traveling really. But I think Holland, like the Netherlands and those places where it's just so clean and tidy and, you know, everything's like compartmentalized, and yeah, I love that part of the world.
Yeah. Okay. Who are y'all's biggest musical influences?
Man, all over the place for us. That's always been, you know, grew up on heavy metal music, so.
Right.
You know, Maiden and Judas Priest and all that.
It's almost like you got to pick a decade, because.
Yeah, you definitely.
The biggest influence on our childhood was probably heavy metal, but the biggest influence in our songwriting probably be like more like Elvis Costello. Definitely. Or the Eagles, Don Henley, but I, you know, as a guitar player, Boston, I love.
Yeah.
So it's like if you threw a year out or a decade out, I could probably name a handful. But it's we're still influenced by, you know, it's 2016, and there's still people that influence us. You know, but we were born in the 70s, and our dad was on the radio, and he'd bring home albums, and so we were little kids. We didn't know what was pop or rock or metal or country.
Mm-hmm.
We liked Kenny Rogers and the Cars, you know, and Van Halen and Dolly Parton. You know,
yeah,
it just was all stuff that we had in our living room on vinyl. So, yeah, there's so many.
Elvis. Definitely.
You like the Elvises.
I do.
Both of them, yeah.
Both.
I want to get a tattoo, and I think one of our friends, I can't remember whose idea it was, but I think I'm gonna steal it before someone gets it. But it's the playing card with Elvis Presley and Elvis Costello. The king up, you know.
Nice.
Kings of both sides.
Speaking of tattoos, you guys both have full sleeves that are amazing.
Yeah. Gotta finish this one, but thank you.
What is your favorite tattoo, and what is your least favorite tattoo that you guys have on your arms?
I think for me, my favorite is probably our my tribute to Al, Big Al, our drummer who we lost. That's my El Nino tattoo, but my least favorite is probably my leg tattoo, my first one. It's like a tribal, I don't know what the hell it is, but it's ugly. It's the only one I think I'd cover up. I've got some, one, you know, tattoos that are kind of silly that I'm like, I wouldn't get that again, but I wouldn't cover them up. But that leg one, I'll cover it.
You're not a fan?
Not a fan.
Okay. Well, everyone makes a first mistake.
But I don't show my legs very often anyway, so.
Well, you should. You have great legs.
Get it covered up with right.
Chicken legs. Those legs look good, AJ.
Thank you. I look good after I get a tattoo of a chicken bone on it.
What about you, Jeremy?
I do have a leg tattoo that has a similar story. It was my first one. And
you guys both did leg tattoos for the first?
Yeah, I don't know why. When we were teenagers, we were like 18, 19, we got our first tattoos, and back then it was like a big commitment, you know? You know, you could start here, but if you could see it from your sleeve, it was going to be harder to get jobs. And
right,
we already had long hair, so it was already hard enough to you know, find jobs that would deal with our band and our lifestyle. And so that was like, and then if you went below the elbow, it was like, oh wow. And
now you really can never
job security.
Way. Yeah.
Now kids keeping are starting on their neck. You'll see, like, you know, you see these kids, and they're literally, their first tattoo is like the whole front of their throat, and they take their
face
shirt off,
tattoos,
and they got nothing
man.
Else. And, but I don't know. I went down to the hand recently, mm-hmm. and so that is a everyday reminder that it's going to be very hard for me to ever put a suit on and go work in the corporate world. So,
but maybe that's kind of why you did it. Just
well,
confirm it, you never will.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I never probably would anyways. But it's a daily reminder that I have to go out and kick ass.
I love that.
Because I don't have a backup option now. Just put a suit on and go work at a wherever.
Right.
Yeah, now you got a hand. It's cool. It's really pretty,
lifestyle
though.
Lifestyle security.
Thank you.
What is that, a skull?
It's a sugar skull, and it's got black diamonds in the eyes, which sort of that ring.
Your ring.
So, yeah. Was that thunder?
It's like a bomb.
I sound like a bomb just went off.
Underground.
What? Okay, so let's start at the beginning. You guys are brothers. Jeremy, how much older are you than AJ?
2 years.
Okay, so you guys formed this first band called Razzle. when AJ, you were 14, and Jeremy, you were 16?
Well, when I was, the band formed around then, but I was a drummer at the time.
I know. Yeah. So you switched to singing. How did that happen?
That was like when I was 16, I started singing because we couldn't find a singer that was, you know, half decent. So I, yeah, I said, I'll give it a shot.
So you did not originally want to sing?
No.
Why?
I love drums and I never really thought about, you know, what instrument. Our grandfather was a drummer, jazz musician. So that was, I was exposed to that and had access to his drum kit. And it was the first instrument I learned how to play. And then I think it's just after playing a show as a drummer, I just realized that was, I didn't want to be cooped up behind a kit.
You need to run free.
I needed to be free.
Run free like the bird that
That's
you are.
That's right.
Okay, so you switched to singing.
Yeah.
And then Jeremy, you are in the band as guitar. You play lead guitar.
Yep.
And you're also the original band members, Kevin, Sean, and Alan. Y'all were together the whole time? Y'all formed Razzle and stayed together through Lit the whole time?
No.
Sean didn't, and well, we started out, I was actually in a couple other bands when I was, you know, 16. I dropped out of high school as a junior to pursue my rock and roll dreams, and they were doing the Razzle thing, and then we all kind of, about a year or two later, we all joined up, and so there was a fifth member guitar player in the early days, and then it was just me, AJ, Kevin, and Al for like 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah.
So that's a huge dedication to stay through all the changing of the band names, the changing of the record labels, all of your musical evolution. Y'all never broke up. Don't you think that's sort of rare?
It is. Yeah, extremely. I mean, it's weird. It's something about, I feel like a lot of Orange County bands have stayed together for a really long time. I don't know if it's...
Why is that?
Maybe it's just the culture that, you know, that SoCal kind of... I don't know. It was family for us, so.
And you guys never had another option of another job. Like, you were like, we're being a band and we're sticking to it. Because sometimes people are scared to commit to a band.
Yeah, you have to, man. I think it's just like anything career-wise, you know, it's just no backup plan. That was the best way. Especially in the entertainment period, you got to have, you know, you got to devote yourself 100%.
We would always have very menial jobs just to and make just enough to, like, cover studio rent for band practice and gas in the car for gigs. And then whatever money we made at the gigs, we would put back into the band to make flyers or print CDs or cassettes or stickers. And we were pretty relentless guerrilla marketers. You know, this is, you know, before social media and that kind of stuff. So our social media was us being socially active, and we would just go out to multiple bars, multiple concerts, multiple anywhere where there was people hanging out that we thought might like what we were doing. We would go there with piles of stuff to give them, and we'd stand outside of shows and just give them. And we and that worked really because we were, you know, by the time we got a record deal, we were.
Is that what got you the record deal? Just going out and hustling and. I think Razzle was your first record deal with Razzle.
We never got a record deal with Razzle.
It switched to Stain.
Stain, right. Yeah.
But then there's another band called Stain, so you came up with Lit, which I love the name Lit.
Lit was the name of the first album, so it was, the band was Stain, the album was called Lit.
But you didn't have a record deal with Stain.
We got signed to
Delicious Vinyl.
Yeah, a hip hop label called Delicious Vinyl.
It was Delicious Vinyl was their, like, you know, Wicked Stepchild. For the rock stuff.
Okay. So Delicious Vinyl.
Yeah.
First record.
They had Tone Loc and they had Young MC and they had The Far Side, and they were like a really cool, especially now looking back, they're a really cool, credible hip hop label. But they had this couple crazy dudes that worked there that were really into rock and roll, and so they convinced them to let them sign a couple of rock bands. And so that was like our.
How did they find you?
And we were in a bar in San Diego in front of like nine people, and they were like two of the nine people.
And they loved it.
Yeah.
So but, how did you guys change from Razzle? Why did y'all dump Razzle, the band name?
I think it's a lot of it was just the evolution of the band. It's when you've been together that long, you grow. We were just little kids when we started the first one. And we just changed. We kind of outgrew it. It just felt too... High school.
Dazzle.
Yeah, it was a little too bright for us.
You guys are bright. What are you talking about? Yeah. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Yeah.
Sunshine.
Not
boys.
That sweet, though.
We were changing. Music was changing. Everything was just kind of, we, you know, I think with any artist, the more you do it, and as you start doing it for longer, you start to figure out what it is that you want to do.
You guys started off more heavy metal-ish, or heavier? right?
Well, we were all over the place. Heavier. Like we still are, kind of. We were never afraid to get really heavy or to get really emotional and, mm-hmm. and sad. You know, we were always kind of pushing it a little farther in either direction. And then I think when we started to have some success, then we started to kind of focus it in a little bit more on what we felt we were the best at.
What do you feel like that is? What are you the best at?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, we are. We geek out on songwriting. We love to, you know, once we started collaborating with other writers, mm-hmm. it sort of exposed us and opened us up to, you know, just not limiting ourselves and always being open to kind of evolve and let it happen. And if it felt right, we just would always go with it. So, you know, if you listen from one album to the next, we've kind of constantly changed a little bit. And
what's the underlying theme, though, that connects all the records?
We like to drink and we like to.
Is that what lit? You know,
we like a good time.
You like to get lit up.
I think lit's more of an energy for us. We've always been kind of lumped into the. We've had in the beginning a lot of stoner followers and people. Oh man, let's get lit.
Oh yeah.
And we're, you know.
Well, we also had the guy who directed our very first video. When he saw us play live, he said, and this is when we were still called Stain. He said, seeing you guys live is like watching a bomb go off in a building. And so we were thinking, oh, that's kind of cool. Bomb, fuse, lit, like getting ready to explode, like that kind of thing. So
finding a band name, it's the worst.
Yeah, it sucks. I hope I don't ever have to do that again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I mean, the process of that is exhausting. Yeah. And then you find when you like Stain, and you realize it's taken. But I think I'm glad y'all moved on.
Yeah, I think lit suits us a lot better.
And actually, the funny story about that is that Stain... The band Stain, mm-hmm. or Stained?
Stained.
Aaron Lewis.
Yeah. Oh, he's doing country music.
Yeah. They got sued by the same guy we got sued by when we were called Stained. But the difference was we were like, F you to the guy. And they were like, all right, we'll pay you. So those guys
really?
Actually paid the guy off. And
yeah. Oh, I thought it was Aaron Lewis's band that was the Stain. That was mm-mm. the problem.
Stained. No, it was like a writer for Thrasher magazine or something.
Yeah,
sitting on the name. Band.
Oh, man. So what was it like? You guys have been playing since you're like teenagers. Now you get this first record deal. What happens now? Like, what is your life looking like?
I mean, after the first record deal, not a whole lot changed. You know, we just kept doing what we were doing and actually had copies of the record to sell. You know, I guess that was the difference. But
were you still like self-promoting or was the record label helping?
They helped a little bit. I mean, what, printed posters and
The first deal was very indie. Sports. And we would go up to Hollywood 2-3 times a week and go in the mailroom and stuff envelopes and stuff, you know, and use their copier to print stuff. And just, we would try to do everything we could to take advantage of whatever resources that there were. But I mean, the real beginning for us was when RCA got a copy of My Own Worst Enemy. And it was weird how it happened because they'd already passed on us like 2 or 3 times.
Did you make that with Malicious? Mm-hmm. Delicious? So you guys were out of your Delicious deal. And now you're a free agent. So that kind of just dissolved over time. It was a great launching point, but it kind of dissolved.
Honestly, I don't even remember. We may have still been with them, and I think they probably just let us go because they knew it would be better for us. I mean, I don't remember all the details then. But
so now you made a new album after that deal.
Well, we did some demos, and on that demo was My Own Worst Enemy, Miserable.
Dang.
They were like, top 5 hits on out of 4 songs
that got passed on.
That everybody passed on.
Can you believe that? Isn't that so funny how the music industry works?
Yeah, cool thing is our manager at the time, Ruta Sepetys, her name was on the CD with her phone number, and a radio promo rep at RCA recognized her name from a college that they went to in Michigan together like years past, and he was like, "Whoa, no way." So he took it into his office and put it in. And he flipped out over that song, and then he was
working at RCA.
Yeah, and so he went down the hall. It was just a weird thing, and then next thing, it happened really fast after that. It went from, they heard it, they wanted it, we signed with them, we were in the studio like 2 weeks later, and then we finished the record right before Christmas time, and then January 2nd, K-Rock started playing My Own Worst Enemy.
Well, there was actually a station that started playing the demo, and we had to they had to send him a cease and desist.
Really?
Letter because it was a demo version and we weren't anywhere near close to, you know, ready to release. So
it was one of those kind of cool, crazy things.
But isn't that those stories crazy because you've now been in the industry, what, like probably 5 to 10 years really doing it at this point?
Yeah, over 10 years.
Over 10 years. And it feels like that's magical. Like someone randomly gets your CD and mm-hmm. then you get a record deal. But there's 10 years of like hustling, developing, but then that's just your lucky break. That's the kind of stories that are crazy because it's really like 10 years of hard work, but then finally something clicks. Sure.
It's the stars eventually have to kind of align in your favor.
Do you believe that?
Totally. I mean, because there's too many people, and I didn't used to believe that.
Tell me about this.
Like 15 years ago, people would say, oh, there's so many talented people that never make it. And I would always kind of felt at that time like, well, no, there's something missing. Like, they might be talented, but they don't have anything for people to invest in. Like, they don't have a vibe or an image, or their show sucks, or they're great in the studio, or vice versa. They're great performers, but they don't write great songs. Or I always just felt like there must be some piece that's missing. Otherwise, why aren't you making it?
So you believe that if all the pieces are together, you will eventually make it?
I used to believe that until I started coming to Nashville.
And then what?
And then I've actually seen a lot of people get kind of overlooked.
But do you think it eventually comes around if you stick with it long enough?
Certainly can. I mean,
times have definitely changed a lot, so that's a tough question to answer.
And with YouTube, there's so much more access to finding artists, I guess.
There's people now that are experiencing a lot of success, and they have no experience. There's people with a lot of experience that never get the success. I don't think that was the case 20 years ago. I think you had to really, 15 years ago, I think you had to really bust ass, develop your local following.
To get heard and seen.
And then maybe
place.
Try to expand that to a regional following. And, I mean, bands that you know, if you think back in like the late 90s or early 2000s, I mean, bands like the Dave Matthews Band that were playing, selling out stadiums, had a huge college following just showing up playing in bars, playing at frat parties. Like they built these like legions of fans over time. And then they sort of turned the tables on the industry, and the industry had to come follow because there was something happening.
There's so much.
And now it's kind of...
Like a band like Dirty Heads is doing that now. You see some bands that still kind of get it and they're working it.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll have following, you know, they'll be able to tour forever.
Right. Because they have their grassroots following they've built. I feel like that is true. Like in Southern California, especially in this era when you guys were emerging, there was a lot of bands coming out of there. Like No Doubt came out of that region too. Who else was in
Offspring, Sugar Ray.
Were you guys all kind of happening at the same time?
They kind of beat us a little bit.
Within a few years, Offspring and No Doubt, and you had, you know, even like Korn and...
Oh, yeah.
But Orange County, I mean, it's so crazy, the history that comes out of there.
Time period was that? What year? What were the years?
That was all 90s-ish.
Okay.
Late 90s into 2000.
And then since then, you've had, you know, bands like Avenged Sevenfold and Young the Giant. And then, I mean, country-wise, too. I mean, there's been, you know, Gary Allen's from Orange County.
Oh, yeah.
And Jackson Brown is actually from Fullerton, where we're from. You know, there's a street that runs through Santa Ana called Raitt, and that's Bonnie Raitt's dad. Named after him. So there's a lot of history in where we come from. It's a really spread out county. It's not like a little scene. It's like we didn't know all those bands until we were, you know,
on tour with them.
We met them in, you know, at some festival in New York or something.
So you guys get signed in this 2-week period. It's like a magical thing that happens. And you're recording your album. You put out My Own Worst Enemy. Tell me what that's like. Because this is the biggest charting rock song in 1999, if ever, right? It's one of the biggest rock songs that ever was.
We had a good run with it.
Was it like 12 weeks at the top of the charts?
11 weeks at number one.
That's insane. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was fun.
What did life look like?
Well, we were still in an RV. And we hadn't...
Everyone thinks it gets so glamorous so fast.
Well, we had
our time kind of before we started blowing our money. And we definitely stayed smart and efficient for a while until we just thought we deserved a little luxury. So we went for the bus.
Well, we got to a point where we couldn't really drive ourselves around anymore. It was getting a little crazy. But when you're in the middle of the country and you have 6 weeks, 7 weeks of dates left and all your stuff is packed in this RV, you have to get home first to unpack it so that you could get a bus.
Yeah.
And so we were pulling up to all these.
So you guys had a tour booked and everything. You're doing your own thing when this happened.
When that song finally got to number one in the summertime, we were out. We were playing Woodstock and playing, you know, on tour with the Offspring and the Warped Tour, and we were doing all this stuff. That year we left home in January, and we left home in January of 99, and we didn't come back till September of 2000.
Really?
Like, literally 18 months we were gone from home.
Like, didn't come home once?
Just not even bring, you know, not even bring your suitcase in, just like bring your backpack in and
wow.
hang for a little bit. But yeah, it was crazy. Like the whole video, you know, treatments too. Like we, the song was before we were like, as soon as it was done recording, we, it was done recording. When we were done recording it, we had, you know, video producers submitting their treatments and we were, you know, kind of thrown into the a makeup room and all this new stuff that, you know, $350,000 video, you know, from never experiencing any of that. And then next thing you know, we're on MTV, we're on TRL. Or,
so what
but that all
like?
Happened really quickly.
Were you guys ready for that? Were you ready for this instant fame? I know y'all had wanted it, but like that changed overnight for you guys, literally, right?
I think we were ready for it. I mean, nothing was like, you know, like you say, we were kind of priming over the course of 10 plus years and we were really comfortable on stage. We were comfortable, you know, we had already done a million interviews and with local fanzines yeah. and things like that. So we're, that's the difference, I think, between something like an American Idol winner and a band that's been kind of put through the
You're not quite ready. The American Idol, like, you haven't had that preparation time period.
You might have some media training and you know, extensive amount of that. But, yeah, not really. When you get on the stage and that connection with a crowd, that happens over, I think, over time, learning how to work that.
So what was the fan situation like? What was, like, were girls just throwing themselves at you guys? Was that crazy to be, like, walking down a street and everyone know who you are? And, Jeremy, at that point, you had a long beard, too, like a long braided beard, which you've cut off. Which I always loved your beard.
Yeah. I had a long beard for a long time, and that was kind of my calling card. But
how did you decide to cut that off?
Actually, it was when our drummer, Al, passed away, and it was kind of an end of an era. So I not to bring it down, but we were at the funeral, and people were putting stuff in the ground, like letters and pictures and bottles of Jack Daniels and drumsticks or whatever, and I didn't have anything to put in there, and I was, like, looking. I'm like, well, my watch isn't really going to do him any good. And so his daughter was there, and I had the gravedigger guy that was over digging another grave, and I called him over. I'm like, hey, you have any scissors? And he went and got me this big old pair of rusty, you know, shears, and his daughter cut it off right there and threw it in the ground with him. So
if you're ever going to cut it off, that's the way to...
So it's kind of a tribute to him, and kind of the end of an era that day. But yeah, so to go back to what you were talking about, I think the only thing about that time that, looking back on it, when I watch videos and I see stuff, I'm like, man, I wish we would have been able to kind of soak that in a little bit more and enjoy that a little bit more, because they had us run so ragged that we didn't know our head from our ass. We didn't know if we were coming or going. And we knew it was awesome and we were having a great time, but a few months in, we were so exhausted because we were just burning the candle at
yeah.
not only both ends, but in the middle too. We just were, it was gnarly. And
how did you guys keep your health up and keep your relationships with the band up? Because that is probably, I guess you'd had all that practice.
A lot of drinking. Kept yeah. it all in perspective.
That was the one thing you learned
the hard way a few times, I guess. You get run down and you start stocking the bus up with vitamins and, you know, to kind of offset the drinking, and you learn how to drink a lot of water. That definitely, you fall down a few times before you
figure out your system.
Yeah.
And you guys always got along, it was just the four of y'all, right?
Mm-hmm.
Y'all always got along?
Yeah.
For the most part?
We always had a road crew that was like family too, so we were just like this, you know, unstoppable unit on the road. That was, yeah, it was really cool looking back.
It was kind of a neat thing that there wasn't really any one particular person that was getting, it was kind of all for one for all, and we would come back into the bus at the end of the night and we were just the same knuckleheads that we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. We still watching the same stuff on the TV, drinking the same cheap beer and you know, playing CeeLo and poker and yep. stuff with our friends. And I think that we had that foundation that we had built, and that's what kind of kept us through all the roller coaster ride.
So my own worst enemy is huge, massive, and then here comes Miserable, and you guys are crawling all over Pamela Anderson, which unfortunately it's not a real version of Pamela Anderson, but it's like a giant Pamela. How was that?
Better. It was killer.
That's the coolest music video I've ever seen. Or what? Thank you.
That's one of my favorite videos of all time.
She eats all of us.
Oh, she eats all of y'all. Who's the last to survive?
I think KJ's the last one.
You hang on the longest?
I was hanging on her ear for a while there at the end. That's an interesting thing you can YouTube is the TV show that Japan did called VIP, mm-hmm. where they wrote an entire episode about the band.
Oh, so nice.
we got our shot at acting and
we're really good actors.
Yeah. I believe it, actually. Yeah.
Especially if you, the one on YouTube, I think, has German subtitles.
It's called Hard Vowels Night. Oh, yeah, that's amazing.
Really gives it a nice touch.
So are you guys friends with Pamela Anderson? Or do you know her?
We were.
She ate you.
She's amazing. She's super. She's great.
We haven't talked to her in a long time, but she was very sweet to do our video.
And that was her prime time, too. Yeah. She was on fire.
Yeah.
A couple years later, we were on tour with Kid Rock, and that was when they were together, and she made a point. You know, when she would come out, she would always make a point to come in our dressing room and hang out with us and say hi and check in. And she was just always very sweet and very down to earth, very, you know, and just a real pro, you know,
yeah.
Just a, she totally knew her drill, and she just kind of, I don't know, it was neat. It was a neat process to be a part of, you know.
The same time period, Jeremy, you did Cribs, which was amazing. I just watched your whole Cribs thing. And you have like a Tiki Jetson vibe going on, is how you described it. Your house. Tell me what that was like.
I've just always been into mid-century modern furniture and stuff, and it's evolved over the years. And I've always kind of just had before music paid the bills, I used to buy and sell furniture, and I used to have to set up the store and set up little scenes and all that. So I've just always kind of had an eye for design and stuff. So the nice thing about that time frame is I was able to afford some stuff that up until then I was only admiring from afar. So mm-hmm. I was able to buy some cool stuff, and it was fun. The Cribs episode, it looked like we were just drinking and partying and had a bunch of friends over at the house.
Yeah.
But that's how it was. Once we were home and got a little bit of time to celebrate with our friends and our family, that was what it was like every night. Just people coming over, people hanging out, barbecuing, having drinks, just, you know, enjoying your first house. I mean, you know how it is. It's just it's awesome. And
people. So you guys are big community people. Like, you guys, y'all love a big group of friends.
We live in a really cool town. Yeah, and we've had the same friends for forever. Yeah, so we like to, and now they all have kids, and they're all married and have their own houses. So we definitely love to get everyone together and barbecue, and that's what it's all about.
So after this time period, you did the My Own Worst Enemy, Miserable, Ziploc. That's another great one.
Yeah, we filmed that at the house where they filmed the Rat Pack movie.
Oh, nice.
So it was just, you know, that was all about. Yeah, everything we love. We're very, we're one of those bands that fancied ourselves, the rock and roll Rat Pack.
When did you guys feel like you have arrived? Like, did you have a moment where you're like, okay, we're doing this. Like, we are stars. We have arrived on the scene. And how did that change your mentality?
I don't know. So I guess it was kind of surreal being in Times Square and, hanging out with like Carson Daly and having, a bunch of kids in the street.
Did you do TRL and stuff?
We did TRL a few times. And yeah, that's like one of the most surreal time periods.
I feel like this was the MTV era too. Like, this is when MTV was so happening. And
yeah, we had never been in New York City. So it was just like, what the hell? It's crazy.
It was, we got very lucky that we were able to see an experience, because that was kind of the end of all that. It was the end of selling a million CDs, and
y'all sold a million CDs.
We sold more than that, but I mean, that was when people still bought CDs. And
platinum artist. That's a very small club.
Anymore, it's like, it's just, where do you
platinum downloads?
If we wanted to go buy a CD right now, well, where would we even go?
I know,
we'd have to go to
Walmart.
Music Row and just walk into an office and grab one, but you wouldn't that we kind of rode that last wave, and we also rode that last wave of MTV playing music videos and their shows like TRL, which would be cool if that element of it came back, because I feel like it's missing that like fan interaction,
that's become now the new TRL is like Twitter and Instagram, I guess that kind of thing, that they can get closer that way. But yeah, it used to be you'd have to like wait out in front of the MTV building or whatever and hope to get a glimpse of someone. With
I remember one of the first, we got to experience what it was like to have fans camped out in front of your hotel.
How was that?
And you get out of your van and try to walk from the van to the lobby, and you have to stop and sign stuff and take pictures. I mean, now it's back then, you know, you'd stay in hotels under fake names so that people couldn't find you. And now people are Twittering, hey, I'm at the such and such hotel, come see me. And it's like a whole different planet now. But it's crazy.
What were y'all's fake names? Are you still
using
them?
A few different ones.
Mine was Mr. Blonde.
I went with Mr. E for a while.
What does Mr. E mean?
Say it again.
Mr. E.
Mystery.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Creative.
There you go. Okay. I think I stole it from someone else. I can't remember. Probably Elvis.
Obviously.
All right.
So you guys toured with a lot of people. Butch Walker, No Doubt, Kid Rock. What were those tours like? How's No Doubt? Gwen Stefani's amazing. And I mean, Nash City,
great.
Blake Shelton, which is super cool.
Yeah, they're all great.
You would have ever paired them together.
I
never.
I mean.
It's a trip. We've never had any bad experiences with tours. We've always been lucky and had a great time with all the bands we've gone out with. I don't know what you think. Gwen's an Anaheim girl. She's like, you know, she's very much like a lot of people we grew up with, and it's very
We're still friends with a lot of the people that we've toured with. And I think there was only one band, and I'm not just saying this because I don't want to throw them under the bus, but I don't even remember their name. But there was one band that we sent home one time after one show because we just always had such good chemistry with anybody that we toured with, and that if we sensed that wasn't going to be the case, we would either pass or we would
nip it.
Yeah.
What was the vibe you liked to tour with? Like, what's the vibe you're looking for on the road?
I mean, going out with 1,000 Horses, that was a fun tour. Yeah. It's just having, we started to feel like just one big band, you know, and everybody, after you're done with sound check, you all meet up for dinner, or, you know, we'd have those guys on our bus all the time and go to the next town with us. And we wanted to feel like one big crew, you know.
That was cool. When 1,000 Horses was getting started, you guys took them out on a tour with you guys.
That was a great time.
Cool moment.
And our fans dug those guys. They're a great band. It was, you know, great guys, great friends. So
you guys just want to have fun. You want to be a family.
Yeah.
Like a band of brothers.
You know, there's too much downtime on the road to if the people that you're around all day or on days off or after the show, if that group of people aren't like your second family, then it makes being on the road even that much more, trying and taxing, because it's just you're there's so many hours of in the day, you know.
And you have to sacrifice a lot to be on the road, like families, wives, not being with them, mm-hmm. or your kids. So you have to make it worth it, I guess. That's what you're saying.
And you do want to have a good time, and you want to help people out too. You want to give bands a shot at stuff, and you also, you know, you want to open up for cool people too. So you can. I mean, it's just the touring community is different. Everybody's in the same kind of boat. Whether you're in four buses or you're in a van, you're still away from your family, you're still away from your kids or your wives or your girlfriends, or and you're doing what you love to do, but you know, there's a lot of, it's not, you know, it's awesome, but it's not easy, you know.
What do you love so much about it? Why is it so awesome?
And you get to do what we love doing, you know,
which is
performing and connecting with people that have already connected with you, to be able to be out on the road and go from town to town and have that in common with all these, you know, people coming to the shows. And we're one of those bands that hangs out with the people that came out to see us. We'll hang out until the last person leaves, you know. So that's what it's all about, is being able to connect.
So you guys never got big heads. You're always cool to hang out.
I don't know about this guy.
we know
where you come from. You know how much work it takes to get there, and without the support of all the fans, you know, you really
got, being an asshole.
You don't have shit.
Okay, so after that big error of like this big record you guys had, a little bit of tragedy, well, a lot of tragedy struck you guys with your parents and your drummer. So how did life change for you guys when that phase hit? And how did it make you reevaluate? Because your drummer passed away and your parents were in a car accident.
Yeah, it was back to back. Well, I don't know how back to back it was, but definitely
it was pretty close.
Period of a couple of years that just felt like no matter what, like you try to get up and you just, man, we kept getting like pulled back down.
Our mom and stepdad were on their Harley and they got hit head on by a drunk driver. So he was killed and she barely survived. She was, you know, really, really critical for a long time and was in the hospital for several months. And so we had to kind of put music on hold for a little while because we, you know, we had to be there 2, 3, 4 shifts a day at the hospital taking turns and, you know, working with the doctors and the nurses and all that. It was a really, like, life-changing time. And then, but what came from that was my first trip to Nashville to start experiencing this place and writing country music and doing all that. And so it opened up as like, it was like this really dark period of time. And then this little window over here kind of opened up and like the sun kind of shined through it. And it was like, oh, okay.
How so, did that window open up?
My, our manager at the time just kind of tricked me into coming out here.
I think you're like country cowboy boots.
I mean, we had been here a bunch of times just on tour and playing, you know, we were fortunate enough to get to play the Starwood and the, but it was, so yeah, there was that. And then we kind of fired back up and then things were starting to ramp back up. We were actually getting ready to go on tour with Kiss in Europe when the news came down about our drummer. So Alan, so then again, then we had to push pause again and then we had to be around to take care of him. And so, and to be there for him and to support him. And that was another several months of being on the pause button. And
not just pause, but we had to decide whether or not we were going to keep, you know, moving forward as a band. We just,
cause y'all have been together 20 years at this point, right?
Yeah. We were never a band that we never had to audition anybody, you know, we just always were, you know, so to decide, okay, well, Al's not in the band. Do we have, you know, we're going to keep playing. We're going to make another record. And I think it was Nathan, who's our drummer now, was close with Alan. And he just sort of, it was just a natural, he had kind of already been helping when Al got really sick and he would get up there with him and take over when he got too tired. And
so
just naturally, he kind of just, you know,
kind
passed
of like
the torch.
Approved by Alan.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that definitely was part of the organic, you know, thing that happened that kept us moving. And then, you know, I think, like Jeremy's talking about, coming here and finding some new inspiration. And then I started coming here with him and met so many great writers and learned how to kind of, you know, expand my horizons writing-wise and have learned a lot. This has been a, you know, the school of Nashville has been pretty crazy.
Were you guys surprised to see that it's not just so, like, podunk like people think? Nashville's really not
at all.
It's so diverse.
Yeah,
it was diverse. I mean, I started coming here 10 years ago, and it's changed 100% since then. But even then, it's pretty diverse. I mean, it's never been this like backwoods country thing. It's always been pretty, yeah, diverse, I guess is the word.
So what has life looked like for you guys in Nashville?
Like today?
Yeah, like with your career. Like what is happening with you guys in the Nashville community? Like what does that look like for y'all?
Are
you guys writing country songs or is Lit going more country or where is the direction of your music these days?
I mean, it has. It's definitely taken on a little bit of a country flavor. I don't know. You know, it depends on who you're asking. You know, when some people, there's people that when they think of country music, they feel like it's gotten so... it's changed so much and the lines have gotten blurred and there's a lot of crossover. So I don't really necessarily think we claim to be country. We just, they definitely have that influence on our music now. And I mean, I think so much of the country music, that's all I listen to. You know, I think it's just been, all these life changes, you know what I mean? When you hear country music, it's a lot more relatable to a guy that's been through, you know, loss and guys that have been married and divorced and have kids now. And
and not even just that, but it's also, you know, we still write songs about having a good time. We still write songs about girls and we still write songs about drinking. And that really has been completely absent from rock and roll in the last 10 years. I don't know of any band that's come out that you hear on a rock station that write songs that have anything to do with what we write songs about.
Mm-hmm.
Country is a different story. We write about the same stuff. And
and country's kind of opened up to rock, I feel like. Like you have Steven Tyler coming in. Even like my husband's band, 1,000 Horses. They're kind of southern rock. Like,
right.
I feel like
it's
opening its arms.
It's not just rock. I mean, there's a lot of bands. I mean, when you see their shows, I mean, it's a rock show with country leaning production with music wise, but it's still It's, I mean, and there's several country artists. I mean, you can't walk down Broadway in any of those honky tonks without hearing them play one of our songs. They're going to play our songs as many times as they're going to play Friends in Low Places.
Right, exactly.
And it's just, we're all singing, you know, there's some bands, we used to say this a long time ago, but it kind of still applies. Like, there's some bands that you listen to with your headphones on, and, you know, with your eyes closed. And then there's some bands that you put on the boombox when you're hanging out with your friends. And we kind of always wanted to be that band.
Yeah. You guys are a great time. Yeah. You like, make
don't,
people happy.
Like, don't dissect our music too much or read too far into it. Just turn it up and just hang out and have a good time. And that's, I think that's why we relate so much to the country audience and they relate to us. And we've, you know, we're such good friends with, like, I mean, our best friends are Thousand Horses and Jamie Johnson and, you know, the guys that, you know, people would be surprised at how intertwined we have been with that community for so as long. many years as we have. But we were talking about this week. It's funny because the fans are kind of the same, and we're, you know, the only people now that I guess that we have to convince, if that's the word you want to use, is the old school gatekeepers that are deciding whether or not the country fans get to hear it. You know,
so true. And there's just a few of them. And they definitely
still holding
hold
that key.
The key. They definitely hold the key.
Yeah.
So, what have you guys learned, like your evolution? How have you guys, you have transitioned so much through your career. What has made all these transitions just flow for you guys? Because y'all have never quit. You know, you've had, what, several record deals, kind of changed direction, you've dealt with tragedy, and yet y'all have been together 20 plus years. How yeah. have you managed to stay fluid?
So, loving making songs and loving playing them live. I mean, ultimately, it's still a process that, I mean, you know, we're going to leave here in a few minutes and go over Jeffrey Steele's house and write with him, one of our favorite writers of all time. And it's such a walking into his place with nothing but a guitar and walking out with a song that you're stuck in your head for 3 days is like, that's mind blowing to us still after 20 years and having some hits and selling some records or whatever, to still be that excited about, I wonder what's going to happen today. I mean, that's the thing. It's like going fishing, you know, you could not catch anything, or it's like golf, you know, that one golf shot will keep you coming back time and time again, even if you suck.
And
so
it's kind of fun that you don't know what you're going to get. It kind of makes it magical.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And it's a process that we've never gotten used to, and it's a process we've never taken for granted. So I think it's that. And then I think also, you know, we have stepped away. We've never stepped away completely, but, you know, I own a bar restaurant in California.
Slide Bar.
Yeah, the Slide Bar.
Which is so rad.
AJ owns a salon. And
both these are in Fullerton.
Yeah.
So we do other things too. So you can't just be 100% all the time one thing, I don't think, because you'll just go crazy. So it's nice to be able to step away and dive into something head first for a couple weeks, and then go back and dive into the music and go out and play some shows, and then come back and spend time with your family, and, you know, go to your kid's football game, and you know.
You guys both have kids?
Yeah, I have a 13-year-old daughter about to enter the fun years.
Gosh.
High school coming up.
Y'all have it coming for you guys.
Yeah. Yep.
It's payback time.
Mm-hmm. And you have a son, Jeremy. Yeah.
Jake is 14.
Yeah. So okay, they're right, same age.
Jake will be beating up the boys that are not being appropriate with Presley.
Okay, she's got built-in security.
So what are you guys looking forward to most musically, 2016? What does it look like for Lit 2016? In the direction you're headed, where are you guys going?
We're stoked on. We've recorded 6 songs so far, like masters. We're here this week writing more. Hopefully, we're just looking to get, we'll have a single out hopefully by summer.
Nice.
And shows coming
get
up.
Get out and play with some of these guys we're talking about.
Heck yeah.
Some more shows.
Okay, so I like to end my podcast with a little thing called Leave Your Light. Just give me some inspiration to all the listeners out there based on your life.
Man.
Hmm. Are we is everybody stumped on this one? Or
it can be anything. It doesn't have to be super deep, or just some inspiration that you tell maybe to some other people trying to do music, or what you have learned through your journey.
And one of my favorite quotes is, if you ain't growing, you're dying. So constantly try and push it a little bit. I'd say keep pushing the envelope. Get out of your comfort zone.
I love that. Got anything to add, Jerry?
I think that if you're, whether you're making music or you're making jewelry or you're doing hair or you're doing any kind of, you're being creative, and if people are into what you're doing and you're getting good feedback, then there's no reason to ever doubt that that couldn't translate into bigger and bigger success. I mean, you always have to kind of look back, and if you're doing something and no one's really reacting, then maybe you got to take a look at it. But if the feeling is like, wow, this is cool, that's how we always felt about our music, and I think that we just followed that. We just hold on to the believers, keep them close, and keep them, you know, motivating you. And the people, I've found that usually the naysayers are just kind of people that have failed in their own, you know, on their own way to wherever they're at. So, so I don't know if that makes any sense.
That's awesome. So, like, believe in yourself and hold on to that little fire.
Yeah. Just be smart about it, you know?
Yeah.
If you're doing something and it's not quite dialed in yet, then dial it in, throw it back out there, you know?
Follow the signs.
So you guys, are y'all good at taking a little bit of constructive criticism?
Sure.
Absolutely. But only to a certain point, you know?
You gotta stay true.
There's a difference between constructive criticism and naysayers, you know? So you kind of have to have a good gauge of what's going to, you know, I guess, who you're listening to.
And social media has really messed up people's ability to be themselves and stick to it, because it doesn't matter what you do. I mean, you could go on Facebook right now and say, hey, I'm going to give away $100 to everybody I see, and there's, you know, 10 or 20 people are going to go, oh, 100, and why not 1,000?
Yeah.
You know, or,
yeah.
Oh, that's stupid. You know, whatever. We're almost forced to post multiple things a day, and you're almost like, you check back and it's like, oh, I wonder why that didn't get very many likes, or you know, the comments are always messes with your head. Like, that, you know, there was a time where you just did your thing and you just went for it. A publicist told me a few years ago, he's like, which I always try to remind AJ, cause he's a little more sensitive to it than I am. But, whatever you do, don't read the blogs or now everything's a blog, but it's like, whatever you do, don't read the blogs. And if you do that, whatever you do, don't read the comments. They're brutal. And I've actually learned over the years that if you don't read them, they really don't exist.
It's true.
That's so true. It's whatever you put in your own reality.
Yeah. If you never read the comment section, a negative comment will never mess up your
day. I've gotten to the point now, too, because you have control. If someone says something rude or negative, you can delete it. For no one sees it. And I've gotten to the point now where I'll leave the, like, most fucked up shit just so I can kind of, and I learned to kind of laugh at it. Like, okay, I'll let the fans, the diehards,
get after them.
Handle this.
That's a great piece of advice, though. Just don't look at it.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard, but it works if you don't.
Okay, you guys, AJ and Jeremy Popoff from the band Lit. Thank you guys for joining me on my podcast, Caroline. You guys are amazing. This will be launching soon. Thanks for having us.
All right.
So happy to have y'all. Peace.
Peace.
Later.
Caroline, she's the queen of talking. Hey, what's on your mind? She's on the inside. She got the scoop on the ones to watch.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I hope that you loved listening to Lit. And next week is really special because it's the week after Mother's Day, and I decided to do a tribute to mothers. And I found three of my favorite new moms, and we are talking everything about motherhood, all of it. And they are real and honest and hilarious, and we have champagne the whole time. I have Kristen Bress joining me. She's married to Preston from Low Cash. They had a huge hit last year called I Love This Life. And she also worked at Big Machine Records, where my husband is signed. And Taylor Swift is signed over there, Florida Georgia Line, Thomas Rhett, the band Perry, Cassidy Pope. There are so many stars, so she has huge insight into the music industry. Audrey Ball Guest is also joining me with Mary Catherine Music. And Audrey, her father was David Ball. He sold over a million albums, and he had a huge song called Riding Shotgun with Private Malone. And Audrey and Mary Catherine were in a trio called the Music, the Mercy Birds. So they have so much to talk about, and they all have little new babies that are precious and adorable. But they just spilled beans and get real with it, and it's really awesome, and it's refreshing to hear. So you are not going to want to miss that, and we laugh a lot, and it's just the best. So tune in next week, and also please subscribe on iTunes. So many of you guys are awesome and listening on my website, carolinehobby.com. But in order to grow this thing and become the number one podcast, I need you guys to go subscribe on iTunes and leave comments. So y'all are the best. See you next week. Thanks. Bye.